Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 124 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back. Welcome aboard. If you notice that my voice sounds a bit weird, it is because I am getting over a lovely summer cold. So please bear with me. I will keep this introduction fairly short. Today, I am speaking with Wasim Muklashi. He is a photographer, filmmaker, volunteer, self-described alpacapreneur, yes, an alpaca entrepreneur. And if you aren't sure what that means, do not worry. You will be well informed by the end of this podcast episode. This is the last of the episodes recorded on the road trip that I took across the Western United States earlier this year. And if you're interested in seeing a little bit more of what that road trip was like and maybe a little behind the scenes of putting together this podcast, then after you listen to this episode, take a look in the show notes. There's a link to the YouTube video I recently released all about that road trip. And with that, why don't you come along with me to a barn on an alpaca farm in Tumalo, Oregon, and listen to this conversation with Wasim Muklashi.
So my name is Wasim Muklashi. Depending on the day and time, I do a bunch of different things now, but mostly a nature travel photographer. As of COVID, as of the last couple of years, I would add alpacapreneur onto that. So a bunch of alpaca stuff has kind of popped into my life, and I'm sure we'll get into that later. But a photographer and alpaca things, all things alpaca.
And I do know another thing about you is that it seems like you're involved in a lot of outdoor adjacent things. Like you've been involved with a nonprofit. You've been involved with, it sounds like, maybe some boards and various other things involving outdoor stuff. So I think we'll hit up, you know, however much of that makes sense.
Sure.
But it seems like you are in a lot of outdoor adjacent realms.
Yes.
Simultaneously, or jump between them.
Yes, and that's kind of what brought me up here. So I don't know how far back you want me to go, but
Let's go as far back as you're ready. If you want to, if you want to discuss your experience with your umbilical cord,
sure.
From that far back. No, but yeah,
that's a much longer podcast.
Tell us how you grew up, where you grew up, all that stuff, and
sure,
and how you ended up being this outdoor dude.
Grew up in L.A. In Los Angeles, and I went to college, you know, went to school, learned a documentary. The whole idea was make documentaries. So I studied anthropology and minored in film to get out of there to do that. Didn't quite work out that way. Kind of went back to LA after I told myself I'm never going to move back to LA. I went to school in Santa Barbara. When I got back to LA, worked at a record label for a couple of years, but moved back into the video and film industry. To my behest, ended up doing mostly advertising and marketing and that kind of stuff for brands and organizations and companies that I just didn't really care about. But I did learn a lot of valuable skills in the video and film and audio and all of that. And then as I started to kind of pull away from that industry, I moved out of the city up into a place. I don't know how many of your listeners know about Topanga Canyon. It's kind of like a little almost a hippie-ish enclave in the mountains between Santa Monica and Malibu. And that's kind of the first time where I realized that there's this outdoor world that I never kind of knew existed. You're surrounded by nothing but, you know, horses and hiking trails. And that's what I started to explore more and more. And as I started to do a lot more hikes, a lot more outdoor photography, I started to get further and further away from the work that I was doing, and I started to get closer and closer to the work that I started to realize I wanted to do, which was more in the outdoor world. So I started volunteering at the local California state parks, the Topanga one, the Malibu Creek State Park. Well, that's a whole other story, but I almost became a park ranger, if you want to get into that. But as I was doing more of the multimedia work and the photography work and the writing work and the outdoor industry, and then got picked up by Samsung as a sponsorship for photography, mostly for the outdoor stuff, which kind of helped boost the profile that started getting me a little more work up in the Pacific Northwest, because most or a lot of the outdoor organizations and industries, especially the nonprofits and brands, are in the Pacific Northwest. So I was flying back and forth to do work up here, and then eventually it's like, why am I flying back and forth to do the work that I like up here instead of just moving up here? So I moved up to Portland. So going back a little to Topanga, you know, now it's more mainstream, but one of the key things on my mind was climate change. And because we were seeing a lot of that happen in the 8-9 years that I was living in Topanga and working in those parks. I mean, you're seeing oak trees just fall over because there's no, you know, water holding the soil together. You're seeing, I mean, you started seeing it and living it. And the wildfires, we were evacuated, I think, 3 times from the place that I was living in. So more exposed to that. And when I moved to Portland, it was very much on my mind that I did not want to see, I wanted to do what I can to not see another generation come up that was not aware of climate change and the effects that it's having on us in our future. So when I moved up there, that's when I got involved with that first nonprofit. It's they're called ECO, Ecology in Classrooms and Outdoors, and it's basically science and nature education to kids in the Title I schools, mostly like poor neighborhoods and poor schools that didn't have access to that. So I got on the board with them, and I literally just left that board about 7 or 8 months ago, but not because I don't have interest in that, but because an opportunity came up to join the steering committee of Earth Day Oregon. Same world, same thing. The passion is still there for that, to do work to, you know, educate people and bring people together around everything nature. So that's kind of in a nutshell how I got from there to here.
Yeah, so you just covered a whole lot of ground in like 4 minutes.
Oh boy.
So we're going to go back and we're going to get some of the details there.
Yes.
So you grew up in LA, but what area in LA did you grow up in? Because when you went back, you moved to Topanga Canyon, which is a very specific region of LA that's quite different than a lot of people's concept of Los Angeles. Did you grow up in a more urban section of LA?
Yeah, very much so. I grew up in Culver City before. Okay. It was like nice Culver City.
Right.
But so Culver City, like Venice area, Mar Vista area. So the West Side is where I grew up. That's where I spent my whole childhood. I was born actually overseas, but I think it was like maybe 7 or 8 months old when they came here, and then West Side, and then went to school in Santa Barbara. But when I came back from UCSB, I actually ended up moving back to Culver City because that's where my friends lived, and they also went to school up in Santa Barbara. We moved to a house in Santa Monica, and then we moved back to Culver City. So I was still on the West Side. As they were, you know, certain things were going in one direction and other things were going, they were going in the entertainment industry direction. I worked at a studio for 4 or 5 years. That's a great job for someone that wants that kind of work, but that wasn't my world. I just wasn't feeling it. And so then that's when I moved to Topanga Canyon, probably about 5 or 6 years after moving back from college. And then the last 8 years I lived in LA was in Topanga Canyon. And yeah, it's not at all what people think. Like if they imagine LA, you wouldn't even imagine that this place existed. Like I grew up there and I had no idea
it
existed.
Because it's very equestrian and it's not quite rural, but closer to rural than Culver City by far.
Yeah, by very far.
Yeah. So you grew up with like a lot of city, heavily populated area, and probably the beaches would have been the closest outdoor locations for you. Like Santa Monica Mountains, not too far from you, but I could definitely see, especially early in life, I would imagine most people would probably be heading to the beaches.
Yeah, and that's what we did every now and then, but we didn't. Both of my parents were just, it was, you know, working a lot. So it wasn't really that opportunity to go up into I literally had no idea that Topanga Canyon State Park or those mountains, or I had no idea that existed.
Right. It's not even that far from you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like right up the, you know, quote unquote hill, but it was the beaches. We'd go to the beach every now and then. And then once every couple years, we'd go to Tahoe. Like we drive up to Tahoe. My parents, you know, they'd hang out in the casinos or whatever and all that. We take the driver around, but
it's so funny to me to think that like, it makes sense sometimes when you think like the people that drive out to the desert,
yep,
areas to go to the casinos where it's still like pretty urban, and unless you have very specific outdoor pursuits, you probably wouldn't think to venture off away from the casinos so much. But Tahoe has this enormous, gorgeous lake,
yes,
all this forest. It's very funny to think you'd go there and then go inside.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did. And then I think we'd take one day where we'd drive around the lake, and there was a pizza place at the top, like at North Tahoe, that we'd stop at every time we went. But as much as the casinos made an impact on them and the buffets and like all that stuff, I think for me, more the outdoors made an impact on me. Like those trees, like I just remember telling my parents once that one day I'm going to live in Tahoe. And it wasn't because of the casinos, you know, it was just the lake and the trees and like, you know, the pine needles. And it was just like some of my best, you know, memories as a kid came from those trips to Tahoe. So I think like that's when the seed was, I guess, kind of planted as far as like the outdoor thing. But I never thought that it was like realistically a possibility to be able to actually live in a place that was, you know, considered, you know, nature-y. Cities were...
Where people go.
Exactly.
Were you guys hitting Tahoe mostly in the summer, or were you getting up there in the winter as well?
No, never in the winter. That was always in the summer. We'd go in, you know, July, August or something, summer vacation sort of thing, and spend a week up there.
So your concept of it was that green forest, warm lake water.
Yeah.
And then maybe like lake activities.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you mentioned early in your big condense a large portion of your life into 4 minutes section that you went to school interested in documentaries, but that was sounded like more of your minor, whereas your major was anthropology, which are two things that I could see going together, but I feel like that means you had a particular focus or direction in mind for your documentary making if you were primarily studying anthropology. Is that accurate?
I wish I could say that was accurate, and I wish I could say I had direction in college. I think that was something that was, it kind of evolved. It was early on, I had no idea that that's what I was going to be interested in pursuing. Or
anthropology?
Anthropology.
Okay, so the documentary, the filmmaking aspect, yes, no?
Okay. Yeah, I've always liked, that's what I would always watch, documentaries. I just always loved nature documentaries, Ken Burns documentaries, things like that. But in school, it was more a process of, okay, so I screwed up my first year. I need to find a way so that I'm not here for 6 years.
What exactly does that mean? Screwed up your first year could mean a number of things. It could mean I took all the wrong courses.
Yes.
Or it could mean I made a bunch of hasty decisions because I'm young. Oh, both.
Yes. Gotcha. All of the above. I was just like, hey, I'm free.
Right.
So yes, all the wrong classes. I think I started, if I remember right, I think I started as like a psychology major.
Look, I'm gonna maybe make you feel better.
Yeah.
Really quickly. So when I went to college, you were able to test out. You were able to do what was called spring testing, and you could test out and get a bunch of credits at LSU. And so I tested out of 15 hours, which is technically a semester. So technically my first semester of college was my second. 5 years later, I graduated from college. So you don't have to feel bad. I started with a head start and still managed to take 5 years.
There we go. I didn't have that, but it was more of a, I was just taking the wrong classes because I was just having fun. I was just like, okay, here I'm free. I'm in college. I'm for the first time in life away from the restraints of being in your parents' home and that sort of thing.
Your decisions for better or worse are your own.
Exactly. Yeah. There we go. And it was for worse for a little while. But the first year in college in the dorms, to this day, they're still some of my best friends. And they were very much involved, or they knew it was film and video, and that's what they wanted to do and study. So I just naturally being around them, we just started making little videos and making stupid little films. And we actually made a near full length film back in that day. And I caught that bug. When I caught that bug while we were doing, you know, just ridiculous little slapstick, you know, fart joke videos and things like that, I knew that in the back of my head that human interest stories was still what I wanted to kind of pursue one way or another. So that's at that point, I had enough credits to be like, okay, I'm going to graduate in four and a half years. How can I tie that into, the only way that I was going to get those credits was if I switched my major, because I had already screwed up that first year, or else I would have had to stay an extra year. So that's when I was like, all right, what majors can I look at where I can still get out of here in four and a half years based on the classes that I took? And anthropology was one of them. I was like, all right, cool. Anthropology. I could learn about, you know, people and history and things like that, and see how that will mix with things. And then the film stuff came towards, I think, the third year. And so then that's when it started to become, okay, I can use this to actually make the kind of movies and media and stuff that I like, documentaries. I can use the idea of you know, human history and stories. And
yeah, it seems like it would be valuable. It seems like it'd be very valuable for documentary making, because I could see where most people would probably have done the opposite. They would get their degree in the filmmaking aspect, and then maybe a minor in anthropology. But I feel like a lot of the filmmaking aspects you will learn on the job, whereas the anthropology aspect, you're going to learn far less of that on the job than you will in a degree program. So it seems like maybe your accidental decision was the better decision.
Well, if it worked out to me making documentaries,
but right.
That's not where it led. I mean, I don't regret any of it. Like, if anything, college, like for the people that know exactly what they want to do, then you have that path and you know you have that direction. For me, it was, I think I learned more about life and life skills and life decisions and kind of the impacts and consequences of that than anything else. And
I think that's one of the values of it, because so much of it, people think of it as like a career-based path. And that certainly is part of it, and that can be there. But there's a really big value of taking a bunch of people of a certain age at a certain stage of life and then introducing them to like different aspects of society and academia at the same time, so that they can, it's almost a way to kind of get a large picture of the world without traveling simultaneously. The unfortunate thing is it's so goddamn expensive.
Yeah.
That you can't justify it to someone as like, oh, it's a good time to go have your experimental stage in life if it's going to cost $500,000.
Yes. Yes, that is true. I like the way that you put it, like it's traveling without traveling, because you do kind of have to figure it all out for the first time while your brain is still being, you know, what is it, like our brain is not fully developed until 24 or 25 or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, you could even argue it's not developed then.
Fair enough.
I think what happens with the brain is it is approaching full development and then it starts to degrade and die with age.
I like to look at it as it likes to narrow its focus.
right. So you finished college. Your intention was to get into documentary making, specifically about the human condition in some form or another.
Yeah, just telling
stories. But you find yourself instead in commercial film production.
Ugh, yeah. Sitting for 6 hours while they turn, you know, every Skittle so the S faces in one way for a Skittle shot, or like it was marketing, advertising, commercials, things like that. So again, like it was great to learn the skills and it was super fun. Like the people on all those sets and all that stuff were, it was fun, but I had no interest in, you know, like Barbie paid a lot of bills. Mattel was a client, things like that, but I had no interest in that stuff.
What department or departments were you in?
Shooting and editing. Okay, so full-time editor. And then I'd shoot some B-roll sometimes. And then depending on the job, and then early on, it was a lot of PA, just a production assistant.
Yeah, that was my assumption. That's worse. Yeah. I figured probably begin PA. So then it sounds like camera department and post-production.
Correct.
Were your two main suits, which are two things that could be very valuable to a documentary filmmaker as well. So it makes sense that you'd end up in those departments. But it also makes sense that you'd be in camera department and then transition towards photography, which is where you end up next, right?
Yes.
Or you mentioned something about a park ranger at some point in there. I don't know if that's in the middle of this transition.
That kind of is. Yeah. Photography, I think when I moved into Topanga Canyon, part of the early story early on was I did take photography as an elective in high school. My dad taught it, I think, at the high school that we went to, and he was a photographer. So he had, you know, he'd set up the dark room in the bathroom, and my mom would get mad and like that whole kind of thing and break it down at the end of the weekend. But my first camera was a pinhole camera I made out of a shoebox for a science fair when I was a kid with my dad. And so I have this memory with my dad and photography, which I think is what got me interested in the visual arts to begin with. But when I moved into the canyon again, so I was starting to get away from that commercial work and that video work, and everything kind of slows down a little bit up there in the canyon. And that's when I got a friend of mine who was a photographer. He convinced me to buy my first digital camera, which I think was a Canon PowerShot something or another.
Yeah, what time period are we talking about if you're talking digital camera?
That would have been 2008-ish, 7
Okay,
or
okay. so around the time that digital cameras are actually becoming a valuable tool.
Correct.
Because if you said 2002, I was going to say like, oh, I remember digital cameras in 2002. They were toys.
Yeah, exactly.
But right. This is right at that point where everyone has finally accepted that, yes, these things are going to replace film in all realms.
Right. Yeah. And I was like, all right, why not? Bought that. And then that, you know, graduated from that to a, oh God, what was the first like DSLR camera? I think a Nikon D40, I want to say. So that would have been probably around that period also, 2010, 2011, which was right around the time that I moved into the canyon. And so I just pulled it out and just started taking pictures of, you know, like I've never lived around horses. I've never lived around like any of these things. So just the stuff that was around me that was different, which led to me taking my camera with me on the hikes. And so then I would start taking pictures of the landscapes and the hikes, which led to me, you know, exploring some of the other hills, some of the other mountains, which led to me taking a drive to Sequoia for the weekend. So photography kind of became almost like a meditation and a way to stay present. Like when you're shooting video, it's one thing, but with photography, it had me there. And you had to be there. I will always look back on my time in Topanga as very, very transformative and healing, because until then it was very go, 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 and you could never really process anything. And then moving up there where things kind of slowed down a little bit, you were almost forced to live with yourself, and which was a good thing, and forced to live with your thoughts. And that just, the photography just helped me be very present and kind of slow down a little bit. I embraced it and I loved it. And to this day, that's it's very much a meditation.
Once you transitioned, you said about 2008, your friend convinced you to get digital camera. Mm-hmm. Once you transitioned to digital, were you fully digital or were you still shooting film?
No, I went fully digital. You know, it's funny, and it's I did go fully digital because of the whole one, it's cheaper.
Yeah, yeah. And immediate feedback.
It's
one of the things that I think young people or people who've grown up, you know, in a digital age maybe don't appreciate. I've met people that, you know, are very young and they're already amazing photographers. Part of it is their skill, and part of it is the fact that they could get that immediate feedback.
Right.
They could shoot practically infinite photos, and they could in one day learn a new skill instead of, well, I'm out of 24 or 36 rolls of film. Let me go get them developed. Yeah. Let me get them back. Let me see what I did wrong. Let me try again a week or two later.
Right.
The ability to learn just accelerates so quickly.
But you have to be aware of that. So that's why I go back to slowing down. Like, so when I say you have to be aware of that, it's really easy these days. It's hard to get a bad shot these days with any of the digital cameras out there. So you can just, you know, spray and pray and one of those shots
right,
is going
to come
out.
Right. And you might not be aware of how you got it.
Exactly.
Right.
But that immediate feedback you're talking about, you can, you know, you take a picture and you can check your shutter speed, you can check your aperture, you can check your exposure, you can check all of that stuff. And so when you're in similar conditions, if you're paying attention and you look at that stuff, then you'll know kind of in your head how to shoot that manually without having to use one of the other, you know, the modes on there. So yes, it is immediate feedback and it is immediate knowledge, but I don't think most people that are using a digital camera are using that to learn photography.
Right. There's that danger of not actually learning how to use your tool and letting your tool do a lot of the work for you.
But enough people are, I think, that now film is making a comeback. So I think Nikon just put out a camera that looks like their old, I think, one of their old film cameras. It's why I've been imploring for one of the digital camera companies to come out with a camera that's a digital camera, but you can only shoot either 24 or 36 images before you have to go offload it and then and then go back out in the field and shoot, because then every image you take is valuable. Then you're paying attention and you're actually there, and you have to pay attention to every one of your settings and all that, because
you know how you can accomplish that. Well, it might not be possible to accomplish it anymore. You just have to buy the correct
size
SD card so that it can only hold that many photos.
That's fair.
Very hard to find one small enough.
But the problem with that is then you can carry a whole bag of those extra SD cards in your backpack.
Well, you could always carry extra film. It's just you have to pay for it all.
That's true. All right, screw that idea.
Yeah, I think you're going to have a hard time convincing camera manufacturers to limit the photos they allow their customers to shoot.
I'd buy one.
So what were you doing with these photos when you take them? Are they strictly for yourself? Are you sharing them somehow? How do you go from, I'm a guy that's taking photos all the time, to Samsung is aware of me?
I was sharing them on, I think, things like at that point, I think it was Flickr. I don't remember when Instagram started, but Flickr was like the main thing. And then this is going to sound weird to people who might be listening to this and have no idea that there was a social network by Google called Google Plus.
Oh, yeah. It's very short-lived.
It was, you know, yes and no.
I would never have remembered that existed if you didn't just bring it up. I was like, is it going to say Friendster?
The weird thing, yeah, right? Or my, yeah. The weird thing is Google Plus actually had, for all of its faults, it was, you know, it is what it is, but it had an incredibly robust photography community. Quickly there, like, because I think at that point it was one of the only platforms where you could share a photo in its full resolution and they wouldn't compress it or anything like that or strip any of its metadata.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Photographers flocked to it.
And it's definitely early on, everything, Facebook, everything would reduce your image to what it could serve quickly and effectively to people, which typically was very small, very bad compression.
Right. Yes, completely crushed. But on Google Plus, you could share the full size. So the photographer community there was very... It was like super robust. It was, I think it was the only reason it stayed around for as long as it did, like Google Plus stayed around for as long as it did, is because of that photographer community on there. And, you know, I grew a following and you can communicate with photographers on there and they would actually reply. And it was just, it was very active. And that's when I think I started to get a little more notice on my photography. And then a friend of mine, how did this happen? I was working, so I had a brief stint at a magazine. So I was an editor at a magazine. This was out in like Woodland Hills, Calabasas areas where the office was. And at the time, Samsung was just making like little family camera, or, you know, little cameras that a family can take around, you know, point and shoot sort of thing. One of the guys that worked there who became a friend, he was a father blogger. So like there was this thing called daddy bloggers and mother bloggers, and I didn't know what that was because I'm not a father, but blogs
it
about
it sounds like the beginning
fatherhood.
Of an insult, but yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. I seem to recall a time when, yeah, there were a lot of blogs that revolved around like parenting. Yeah,
that's what it was. And he was so somehow he got involved with Samsung because of his family and his blog. So they had sent him a camera, but then they ventured into producing professional camera equipment. So like DSLR style cameras. And then so they were looking to expand their network. And I guess they talked to some of the people that already they were working with to see if they knew any photographers. And, you know, they got this pool of photographers and I was lucky to be chosen as one of them. So that's how the relationship with Samsung began. That was awesome. That was another boon. So it went from, you know, just posting photography on Google Plus or Instagram and building a community there and starting to get a little bit of exposure there to the Samsung partnership, which took it to another level. Because at that point, then they're putting your photos out on, you know, on advertising material, on billboards and they've, you know, go at conferences and things like that.
Right. They're essentially vouching for you and telling the world, hey, this guy is a photographer worth paying attention to.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. And it was awesome. Other than they'd have me do, you know, like part of the deal was you'd have to do some public speaking and some conferences and show up and this and that. And that made me nervous as all hell because I'm not a huge public speaker. But then when you do things like that, then other people would approach you and then you would get more work or you would get more interest in your work. And, you know, a photography podcast came along and I got on that and then that got me some work. And it was just, it's just one of those things where I think like, if it's something that you really enjoy and something that you're not trying to convince yourself that you enjoy, then it just kind of rolls. Like it just comes naturally. And like, I didn't, you know, go after any of these things. They just kind of showed up. And when they showed up, I jumped on them. That's how that whole thing started. And so then I started getting more photography work.
We were talking earlier about how originally when you got into the film industry, It ended up being in commercial work, which was not your passion. But as you move into photography, a lot of it's based in nature photography. Mm-hmm. But at some point, it is now becoming a career path and you're getting work for it, Which could very easily turn into static equivalents of that commercial work you were doing in film production. So what did that work look like that was coming in? Was it a lot of commercial work? Was it a lot of, no, we want you to go out into nature and bring us back images of landscapes and animals and things of that sort? What was the work you were getting?
A little of this and a little of that. So some of it was, I did help with a campaign for Subaru. So for when they were first putting out their, I forgot, they had like an environmental site for sustainability and stuff. So that was, yes, commercial work, but at the same time, it was also nature. Their whole mission was to promote sustainability. And so like it still fell in with that sort of thing. If it was, you know, if something like a Hummer came around and asked me to like, you know, I probably would have said no. Like even if that, like however big that paycheck would have been. So some work for the World Forestry Center was a lot of it. So they were flying me up to Portland. That's where the World Forestry Center existed. And so they were tackling things like, you know, climate change and forest fires and stuff like that. So a lot of the work was for them as they were promoting things like sustainability and more awareness towards just a changing climate.
Let's use that one as an example.
Sure.
Because I think that's great because that is already showing like, oh, this is something more in tune with what you're interested in doing. When they contact you and they hire you to come do this job, what does that job look like? They fly you up there, but what do they have you photographing? Are you photographing something that they are doing as an organization? Do they give you a shot list and ask you to go acquire things? Mm-hmm. What happens once you get up to the area and you're supposed to start photographing?
So this is where I kind of got to mix in a little bit of that, the video work and the video experience that I had and the photography stuff. So they were putting on at that point conferences. So like kind of like think tank conferences to bring people and speakers and thought leaders and all that together on how to kind of combat the things that we were starting to see as far as the climate. So they were putting on speaker events. They were putting on, they had like a international fellowship where fellows were coming from around the world from their respective like forestry industries or outdoor nature industries and coming here to learn from what America is doing, where at the same time, I think America was learning just as much from them as they were from us, but
hopefully,
yeah, seriously. But so it was a lot of speaker series and then a lot of like the forests, like they'd want images of like the surrounding forests in the Pacific Northwest, or they want images of things that were happening in the forest, whether it be a mushroom or whether it would be a soil sample or even people just recreating in the outdoors. And then, you know, sustainable tree farms that they were, you know, like there was I forget the name of the podcast. I think it was called Timber Wars, but like it kind of breaks down like the whole story politically and environmentally of what happened here in the Pacific Northwest as far as logging and, you know, back in that day. But there's been a lot of effort to regrow and replant and renature a lot of areas that we lost. Then a big piece of that also is they've been, I think for the first time maybe ever, is consulting with like the native tribes in the area that knew how to manage these forests and knew how to manage, you know, like take care of nature. And so I think I'm straying from your question, but most of it was video and photography on everything from their speakers to their speaker series to their fellowship to their, you know, international fellows that would come and they'd go on field trips to see everything involved in forestry and forests and then the forests themselves. So depending on the project and depending on what department there, it could range across that broad spectrum of stuff. So
yeah, so what it sounds like is it would be a mix of event photography. Mm-hmm. So this event is occurring. We want you to document it in your photographs.
Yep.
To in the field work. Mm-hmm. So this is occurring. We want you to document this thing occurring in the field. Yep. You mentioned even recreation. So would that be like go out to an area where people are recreating or treat it like a film shoot and get a bunch of people together to do staged photographs of recreating?
Oh, a little both, actually. But for the most part, it was just they wanted images of people recreating in the forests. Some of it, you know, it could be staged in the sense of like bring a couple of your friends or something like that. But some of it was also, you know, we're right on the gorge. And so.
Right. So you're naturally going to find people.
There's, yeah.
Kite surfing and all
exactly.
sorts of things there. Yeah,
exactly.
And then in addition to that, would there be, hey, we're going to leave you alone for a few days. Why don't you go out into these areas and come back with what you find that is worthwhile there?
For them, that would happen occasionally, but most of the time they had like a scope of work so they would know exactly what they were looking for, what they needed. But then because of that, just because I was just out there hiking or camping or whatever I was doing just for myself, I would be taking images as well. And then through those connections, like I think Nature Conservancy had an office at the World Forestry Center offices at that point. And so then they used some of my imagery, which worked out. And then like, you know, I just have my own library of photos and just through networking. And they're like, do you have a photo of this? Do you have a photo of this? And you're like, oh yeah, I got a photo of that. And so I guess like to answer your question, it wasn't specifically like the World Forestry Center wouldn't ask me to go out there and just take a bunch of pictures and like they take those. But when I'm out there taking a bunch of pictures, like a lot of them would end up with somebody else just in the nature of that's what they were looking for.
So, right, because you build this own portfolio in your own time, and right. then sometimes you can resell those photos
yep.
to clients for other usage.
Yep.
So Samsung's become interested in you. You've started working with them, other clients. That's opening you up to all sorts of other worlds. And I know eventually you are going to get into, we're going to fall into those years where everyone was suddenly interested for a certain amount of time in VR.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us about your experiences there?
That was a big eye opener. That was, so again, that was a Samsung thing. They had put out one of the first VR headsets, which was that Gear VR thing. I think, I don't know if you remember, you put your phone in the front of it and all that.
That was that early stage where it's like, this is a cool idea. It's great that this thing that's in your pocket could already be used,
yes.
but not a great experience. It would hurt your eyes. You could only wear it for so many minutes before it was intolerable.
It had its issues, that's for sure.
But a nice starting stepping stone.
Yes. And it was actually, it was a pretty mind-blowing stepping stone. I was, if I remember right, I think it was a conference in Seattle. It was a photography conference put on by a photography website called DP Review, which is a lot of people... It's more of a technical website, mm-hmm. so like if you're looking for information about cameras, you'd go there. But they had partnered with Samsung to put on this this conference up there, and they asked me to speak, and so I gave a presentation there, and that was actually about nature photography. But then I forget what his position was. He was, I think, one of the heads of marketing or something. He's like, "You want to see something cool?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course." So he took me to the back area, and they had what was a prototype of their like stereoscopic VR camera. And I think, I want to say it was 16 lenses, I think. And he put the headset on me, and that was the first time I had put a headset on. And all of a sudden, I'm sitting in a field full of sheep in Ireland, I believe it was. And then he switched to something else. And immediately, I saw the application of this. So coming from a city, not really being too involved with nature and all that, I immediately saw how this can ironically connect people to nature. And that was the first thought that I had in my head because, so I'm going to rewind kind of a little bit, but.
Do you need me to make a rewind sound effect?
Yeah, no. I think the impact that it had on me was that I could be somewhere and experience something that was not where I was and not what I was experiencing, right. but it was weird that the brain somehow was tricked into thinking that you were actually there. Like, you know, one part, like my hand goes out to like reach out for a sheep, but there's no sheep there. Mm-hmm. And I know, you know, I'm standing there, but like immediately, like it was just, I was very enamored by the, like I immediately saw the possibilities on using this to connect people to something they may not be connected with. And I drew back on my thoughts of, or my experience of not being connected to nature really when I was a kid and being like, oh my God, if I could have had something like this that would have made me interested in this sheep in front of me or this field in front of me, then I'd want to go see this thing in real life, or I'd be more curious about it to start exploring it. And so they wanted someone to test that prototype or like to try it out for a couple of things. And so they asked if I wanted to help with that. And I immediately said, yes, I want to be involved and see like where this goes. So our first experience was probably the best job I've ever had to date was they sent us to Tahiti with this thing to go photograph and film a bunch of stuff out in Tahiti. So like we took it underwater. We took it like to one of like the little Motus, which is like a little island out there. We took it to one of the resorts that are there. And right away, I knew that this was something that I wanted to... Like I saw the future, like I just saw the future. Like once you put it on, it's hard not to see like where the future of that can go. And I wanted to use that to help bring attention to some of the issues that we're having in nature. And if there's a way to connect people that aren't able to get out there to at least be curious about it, like if I could give 100 people an experience and one of them started to become interested in it that wasn't before, then to me, that's a success. And the schools that we were working with at the time with that nonprofit I was telling you about were all Title I schools. And these kids grew up literally 15 minutes from the gorge, one of the most beautiful natural scenic areas on the planet, and they've never seen a waterfall. And right. I'm like, how
and
is
they
that
have
possible?
Hundreds of them right around them.
Yeah. Right there. And then, you know, you learn and their parents can't, there's no time. Some of them are, you know, single parents, or some of them are working, you know, 2-3 jobs. They don't have...
Right. It's hard to prioritize right. that sort of thing.
Yeah. yeah.
When survival is your priority, it's hard to prioritize things that aren't survival based.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this was, that was kind of a light bulb that went off. And at that time also, like I think the nonprofit world was starting to really embrace it as a way to kind of connect people to their mission and like what they were doing out there. And I was like, I couldn't think of a better way to, I know it sounds ironic, but to like connect people to the outdoors using than by using virtual reality.
Right. If you can't take them there literally,
right,
you can at least take them there in their brain.
Yes. And the image, I mean, you can do a 2D image, whether it's photo can go so far, a video can go so far, but the rest of the pixels of life around that 2D image you're looking at is reality. Like, so you're not completely immersed, but with that, you were completely immersed. And so then that's kind of what drew me towards pursuing that. We did some jobs. We did one for the nonprofit that I was working with, actually. And then we started setting up some, I was just on a mission at that point. And so we started, like, I was showing it to all my contacts in the Pacific Northwest. And I, you know, go to meetings with different nonprofits and well-aligned, you know, value-aligned organizations. And we started to, I mean, we got to the point where we were already drawing out budgets for things. And then 2020 hit. Right. And everything came to a skid, which sucked.
I want to talk a little bit about the approach of shooting, because I'm assuming this was always 360, not 180 VR.
Yeah.
So you before, you know, have worked in both video and still photography, mm-hmm. but those are both two-dimensional.
Correct.
It is about finding a frame in an area and capturing specifically what is within that frame. But with 360, it's capturing everything that is around that central point. So bringing a photographer out to do that, you've got to approach this in a different way than you typically would with photography. So what was your strategy there once you get out to Tahiti and these other places that you're shooting? How did you decide, yes, this is where the camera needs to live? This is what we need to capture. And you have no control over the environment either.
No.
in this regard.
You learn that quickly. trial and error. And then eventually you start learning to look in all those directions. So like, I mean, you'll just stand there and turn around in a circle, and you have to make sure that there's something interesting in each, you know, if someone's going to turn their head, there's got to be something there for them to look at that's not like a dumpster or like a wall or something like that. So you start to look at the world in 360. So you're kind of like actually more aware than you are when you're shooting, you know, photography or video in a certain sense. But the weird part there is that because we're so used to, like, let's say that you're standing in front of me in a virtual reality video and you're talking to me, like, you have to create movement. Otherwise, why are you shooting 360? So that was the weird part that you kind of like had to learn, because otherwise someone could put on, you know, the goggles and they're just going to be looking in front of them the whole time. So what's the point of them putting on those goggles? So now you realize you have to start creating movement. So if someone is talking to you, you start to direct them to start talking, you know, walking slowly in a circle. So people start to naturally turn their heads, and that's when the aha moment comes. Or
yeah, you have to play with the soundscape where they can hear the sound of a waterfall behind them and they don't know why. So they have to turn around to see it. Right. Those
but that came later, like ambisonic, all that stuff came later, because originally it was just regular stereo sound. Like they
And you're not doing 3D VR at this point either, right? You're doing strictly.
No, that was 3D VR.
Oh,
that was
3D
the first.
Simultaneously.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you've got to take that in consideration as well. Because if objects are too close, they could cause people to go cross-eyed, cause headaches, right?
Yep. And we learned all of that. And, and some stuff you couldn't control, like when we were shooting the reef sharks in Tahiti, like they would, you can't control where those things are going, like how close they're going to come to the lens.
You can't train a reef shark.
No, not at all. But it started to, like, you start to realize like the distance it has to be away from, like it was definitely a learning curve. Mm-hmm. And we learned a lot on that. And the other part is, like, you can't be in the shot. Your equipment can't be in the shot. You know, you can't have Video Village sitting right there.
Right.
You can't
have a reflector. You can't have...
Right. None of that. And so your natural environment is what you have. These days, you know, it's advanced quite a bit since then. So people can shoot things on green screen or or 180, like you were talking about. And then you can add the other 180 of the sphere like mm-hmm. later. But it's... If you're shooting just natural, you know, 360 video, then you have no control over lighting. You have, I mean, to a certain extent, you could like hide like LED lights or something like that if you want, but it's what you see is what you get. It's not as produced as you can make it with video or with photography.
Right. And then you're also dealing with a variety of exposures, because one of your lenses, if not multiple of your lenses, are pointed in the direction of the sun. Mm-hmm. The others are not.
Yes.
some are pointed at an angle to the sun, and they all have to acquire either different exposures that you're going to have to try to marry into one, or they all need to acquire the same exposure, which means something's overexposed, something's underexposed.
Yes. Right. And that's where the stitching software has become incredible, to be able to do that. Even at that point, like we did it was off of Catalina. We did, I forget, Doug Aitken, I think was the artist's name. And he had he was trying to bring attention to climate change and sea life. And he had an art installation that he put underwater and just like right off of Avalon and Catalina. And so you had to like dive to go see these art installations. So then we had to put the VR camera into this crazy setup, you know, like waterproof housing and all that. But what we didn't realize until later was the stitching process was there's no horizon and there's no like the frame of reference to be able to stitch something when you're underwater going like this.
You're also going to have a lot more motion because the camera is not sitting on.
Yep.
Well, theoretically, maybe you could have set it on a tripod on the ocean floor, but if you're swimming with it,
swimming with it,
it's constantly
moving.
We had
our DP in a dive suit, and she was holding on to the thing. But that's when get that stitched was a process, and the stitchers were charging, you know, anywhere between like $1,000 to $2,000 per stitched minute, especially for something complicated like that at that point. Now it's crazy. It's like the software does it. Like somehow it like takes a reading of this and a reading of that, and it just does it immediately. So it's
There was some auto stitching too. It just didn't give you the results that you wanted.
No, not at all. Yeah. There's a lot of footage we did not put out there to the world.
And there are a lot of times people would just say, okay, well then just stick a logo or something over that section and call it good.
Yep, basically. That did happen a lot.
So did you get to see any results before COVID kind of killed these things? Did you get to see get any feedback or see any results from your work getting into hands of other people?
Getting into the hands of that, no. I think the closest was, I was talking to you earlier about Standing Rock. So that was actually sent out there by AJ Plus, which was a news organization, to cover it in 360 because they were starting to get into that also. So I think that took, maybe about 4 or 5 months for them to put that together and put that out. So that would have been 2017.
And you're talking about the pipeline protest in North Dakota, correct?
The Dakota Access Pipeline, yeah. As far as in the the using that specific camera or using that stereoscopic one, you might have to cut some of this out as I try to remember. But
no, I'm just going to loop this section. I'm just going to loop it for 45 minutes. Or were you building all of this work and then COVID killed it before
we were doing is, yeah. So it was, I mean, we had something that we were planning with Mariposa County and Yosemite. We had something that was working with the Friends of the Gorge. At the time, there was also a project that they were putting together called Towns to Trails, I think is what it was called. So it was basically they were going to make a backpacking loop around the gorge on both Oregon and Washington. And then each night you would stay in like either one of the towns there or like a winery there or like a campsite there. So they were making like a backpack loop there. And I was like, oh, that's perfect for that. So we started talking to them and we started drawing up budgets. And like at that point, it was the period where people were starting to be like, okay, this is not going away. This is a thing and this is growing. I had a bunch of prototype experiences. Also, I shot one in the Santa Monica Mountains. We shot one with Eco, like I said here. I did one on the High Divide. We backpacked the High Divide Trail up in Olympic National Park. So we shot that as like also a proof of concept. And all the meetings were happening. All the budgets were starting to be put in place. And then, 2020 hit and everything just came to a skid.
And so they just haven't been resurrected?
No, I think there was a lot of pivoting. And after that, even I had to make a major pivot. I'm not living in Portland anymore. And, you know, now I'm in Central Oregon and that wasn't expected at all. Actually, that was the last job that I shot 360. It was November 2019. A nonprofit I was working with called Quechua Benefit. They work in Peru. They work up in the highlands in the Altiplano up in the Andes. And they have everything from schools to medical, like they're building schools and medical facilities and orphanages. And they have a lot of projects up there in an area that's probably one of the poorest areas I've ever been to in my life. But one of the things that they're doing up there and that they took us up there for was something called a vicuña chacu. And a vicuña is in the same family as alpacas, llamas, guanacos. It's a camelid. And if you look at the Peruvian flag, it's actually a vicuña that's on the Peruvian flag. A lot of people think it's an alpaca or a llama, but I had no idea what these things were. I just knew that this nonprofit had hired me to go up there and photograph and capture in 360 all of the projects that they're doing up there, to help bring that back to their donors and to help, you know, bring attention to their work. And the vicuña is an animal that has the finest fiber in the world. Jackets go for anywhere from like $5,000 to $15,000, which is crazy to think, but it is a super, super fine fiber, but they can't be domesticated. So they're wild animals. So they were being poached. And so they went from, I forget how many hundreds of thousands a head down to in the tens of thousands. And it was a main source of income for a lot of the communities up there. And so they got together. A project was born with the government and this nonprofit, and some partners to stop poaching them and raise them sustainably. But because they're wild, you can't just put them in a pasture like these ones that you're seeing out here with the alpacas. They went back to what they used to do during the Incan sun god days. So it's an ancient ritual called the chacu. And all the communities would take a little piece of rope or ribbon and they would go and disperse into the highlands, kilometers. And we're talking to like 15,000 feet, which is... Oh my God, that altitude sickness was something I've never
expected. Oh, right. You're talking about 15,000 feet in altitude, right.
I don't know how they were climbing those hills at that speed. Right. But
you're higher than Mount Whitney
at that point. Yeah, it was up there. But essentially what they're doing is corralling them from the hills and in the highlands little by little. They bring them in, they corral them into this valley, and then they hold this big ceremony. And they shear them and they let them go back out for a couple of more years so that they grow enough fiber for them to do that again. And that has brought them back to almost 500,000 head at this point. So it's one of those rare, successful conservation stories.
And this was one of the stories you were telling through 360?
Yes. And so I got to go up there and sit in the middle of all of these vicuña, and I still haven't published this. It'll be coming soon. That was the last 360 project I was able to do. That kind of led to my fascination with the alpaca and camelid world. When COVID hit, I was living in Portland still, and I was living downstairs in an Airbnb apartment from good friends, but they're a bit of an elderly couple. And so they were we still didn't know what the heck was going on with COVID. This is just a couple months after we got back from that trip. I didn't want to get them sick. No one knew what was going on. So I moved out of there, kind of hopping around, looking for a place to permanently stay for a little bit, thinking COVID was just going to be a couple of weeks or maybe a couple of months.
I remember those days, people. Remember those days? We thought this was just a quick little thing we'd get over with.
It wasn't. Eventually, I spent a month, I think, down near San Diego, where my parents live in Southern California, just so I can kind of be near them and see them during part of that. And then eventually I needed to get back to Oregon and I still couldn't move in with them because we didn't know what was going on. And so then I just started calling around people that lived up here and who wouldn't mind someone sleeping on their couch who might be carrying the plague. And I found the tour guide on that trip to Peru had an alpaca farm. She was an alpaca judge, an alpaca farmer, and alpaca everything. And she has a farm up in the Bend area in Central Oregon. And she's like, "Hey, come stay up here and live in the barn if you want." I said, "Sure, I'll do it." And so moved up here. I think it was that August or September of 2020. Again, still thinking that I'd be here for a couple of months and go back to Portland when life got back to, you know, quote unquote normal. But that was 4 years ago now.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're talking about 2020 and it is currently March? What month is this? March of 2024. Yes.
It is kind of wild. It is kind of wild. As I stayed up here, you know, as one does, you just start to build a life where you're at and start to build a community where you're at. And then opportunities started to arise here. And as soon as I let go of the idea that I was going to be able to keep doing photography, travel and outdoor photography as part of my main source of income, as soon as I let go of that at that point, because that wasn't happening.
Right, because that just wasn't an option at that point. Yeah.
Then other opportunities start to open up and I grabbed them and here I am now. And still doing photography, not as much for commercial or outside purposes, but more for personal purposes, which I'm actually quite happy about. I've fallen very deep into the alpaca world as well.
So this sounds like a great time to explain to everyone where you and I are seated. and what this place is and what you're doing here.
So we are seated under the eaves of a barn on an alpaca farm in central Oregon in a town called Tumalo, right between, kind of like it's in the middle of a triangle between Terrebonne, where Smith Rock is. I think a lot of your listeners will know where that is. And then Bend and Sisters and the Redmond area. So it's an agricultural area, but this is an alpaca farm that belongs to Amanda Vandenbosch, who is, she was the tour guide on that trip. That's where I met her in Peru. And we just struck a friendship even at that point. So it's everything from a breeding farm to an import export farm. And they do a lot of educational events here. So every year I think it's the biggest educational event for alpaca and camelid owners in the country, which I didn't even know was a thing, an alpaca conference. But I'm saying it now like this is normal, but
no. There are conferences for everything. No matter how small and obscure you think something is, there are enough people that are interested that there is a conference.
And this is where one of them happens. We're on her farm, and this is where I lived for almost a year, I think. And as I was living here, I just got involved more and more with her project. She's been kind of revolutionizing the judging industry. She's been pushing the sustainability of it. She has a adopted Peruvian daughter also, so she's very involved with Quechua benefit and just giving back to that community. And just our values just kind of aligned, and opportunities kind of arose to pursue here. When I was in the barn, and it was still during lockdown period, and you couldn't really see anybody or go out and do anything because everything was closed, the alpacas that you're seeing out here in the field just kind of became my friends. I'd go out and have my lunch with them every day, sit out, have my coffee with them every day. And then that kind of bore the idea of, like, we're in the middle of this crappy year that just keeps getting crappier and crappier for different reasons. But these little buggers are putting a smile on all of our faces. And as we started to come out of COVID, phase of COVID, and people were starting to do things again, we're like, you know what? Other people kind of need smiles right now. So we're like, let's have people come here for picnics with the alpacas. And so then we started the alpacas, or the paca picnics. And we started during tourist season, because it's a very heavy tourist town, especially in the spring and summer. We started booking alpaca picnics, not knowing how it would go. And it ended up getting crazy. And this is now where we're coming into our third season of doing alpaca picnics with people. So we give them a catered lunch and put them in the field, and they hang out with the alpacas. And it gives us a chance to, one, put some joy and smile back into people's lives and on their faces. I don't think there's a single person that's left the farm without, like, a huge shit. Oh, am I allowed to say that?
You can say whatever you want.
Shit-eating grin on their face. And so the alpaca picnic started from us sitting in the field, having our coffee or having lunch with the alpacas, and we're like, we just need to share this with people. And so then that led to some of the organizations, where Visit Bend came out and did a video about it, and there was an article about it, and then they just kind of like took on a life of their own. And then an opportunity came up to purchase a little alpaca store that is in a little town close by here called Sisters. So she was friends with the previous owner, and he was selling the store and the business, and they were moving, and she asked if I wanted to get involved with that, and I was like, sure, why not? So we bought that. I think as people were coming on here for the picnic, like, I was so enamored with the animal because it was new to me, but she's been dealing with them for, you know, 25, 30 years. So to her, it's just a normal thing, but she was kind of enamored with my fascination of, like, how much joy these things can bring to people. And so that kind of, like, reinvigorated that part of her, I think. And then it started the process of connecting people to the product that they're wearing. And it's a natural fiber, and it's one of the most sustainable fibers on the planet. The animals themselves are one of the most sustainable animals, especially as far as, like, livestock is concerned. They're incredibly gentle on everything from the fences to the grass. They don't even have, you know, top teeth. It's just bottom teeth, so they don't, like, dig into the grass. They just kind of, like, scrape it, so it's they're not destroying, like, any of the pastures. But
do they chew if they only have lower teeth?
So it's just the front teeth, the lower front teeth, but then, yeah, they chew. So they have
molars.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And so the mission started to become clear, which was to connect people to a natural fiber, to get them away from synthetics that has, like, all these wonderful properties that really no other natural fiber has. When we bought the store, that was at the forefront of our mind, is to kind of connect people to, one, the sustainability of the fiber, and two, where the fiber came from and why we're blessed with this fiber and those communities and and South America, especially in Peru and Bolivia, that it is there. It's so incredibly impoverished. So a big part of the mission has been to find ways to give back to those communities and empower, especially like, I mean, these are, you know, women weavers sitting at home that are working also six other jobs like in a day just to barely pay the bills and just to barely put food, you know, on their plate. Neither of us had any interest in just buying wholesale and selling retail product. Like the whole point of this is to connect people to the source of that product and have them like have an emotional connection to the natural world, like through that product. So that's the journey I've been on since that was my pandemic pivot in a way, I guess.
So let's talk about the animal a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think people are, in the US at least, are becoming increasingly aware of alpaca, but they're not the most common animal in this country. People are more familiar with camels and llamas, which have very particular characteristics and are very large and potentially dangerous. So tell our audience about how alpacas are different and what alpacas are like in their own right.
In almost every way. So the closest cousin to the alpaca would be the llama, and that's what most people would know. And I would hesitate to put you in a field full of llamas for a picnic.
Because it will rip your arm off with its teeth.
Or kick or spit or something crazy. But they are huge. They're about four times the size, almost four times the size of an alpaca. They can grow to be very large.
You were also telling me earlier that people use llamas to scare off coyotes.
They do. Yes, they are guard animals. So they use them to scare off coyotes, wild cats, anything that tries to get into the pastures to get, you know, any of the other animals that you have that those things might be after, whether they be chickens or pigs or they've sometimes tried to come after little crias. The baby alpaca or baby llama is called a cria. So sometimes they'll try to get into the field to get the cria, and they'll use either a llama or a full grown alpaca, like a adult alpaca to scare away. They're guard animals, which is kind of crazy. But llamas are raised and bred in for their conformation as far as as pack animals mostly. So they're used as like guard animals or pack animals to take things out like into the like expeditions or into the wilderness. They're very strong boned as far as that's concerned. You can't really use too much of their fiber for anything that you're going to be wearing to skin. Whereas alpacas are the opposite. They're much smaller. They're much, much, much cuter, in my opinion.
They basically just look like, I mean, I know you guys make alpaca socks, but they kind of just look like giant socks.
Basically. Basically. Huge, huge balls of floof that can barely see out of their eyes right now because they got so much fleece on them. But they're bred for their fibers. Well, in South America, they're also, some of them are bred for as a source of protein. But here, they're mostly bred for their fiber because it's one of the finest, softest fibers in the world. And it has a lot of qualities. It's a hollow fiber. It's a hypoallergenic fiber. It doesn't have lanolin on it like sheep wool does. And it's super soft. It's super warm. And it's very good at thermoregulation. So like I'll wear the same, this is too much information, but I don't care at this point. I'll wear the same pair of socks 2 or 3 days hiking in a row. And the sweat just, it's not even there. It just evaporates right through it.
You're talking to a podcast where a lot of the listeners are backpackers who may wear the same underwear and socks for 3 to 6 days at a time.
Just flip it inside out, right? Yeah, like, so it is a very unique animal and very unique fiber. And the more I learn about it, the more smitten I am with these buggers. But it's, you know, it all started with just how ridiculously goofy they are. They're just goofy and cute, but they do provide us with a really, really remarkable natural product. So,
and from what I can tell, they do not appear to attack people or bite people or spit on people or any of the things that people know that camels and llamas may do.
They do not, for the most part. Like if there's a couple of them and they're like fighting for the same little source of food, they'll spit on each other, but not on you.
So does that mean for your pack of picnics that children are safe?
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
What about toddlers?
We've had some toddlers before as well. Yep. We make sure to put the friendliest of the bunch in the field with you for the picnics.
Are the alpacas safe from the people?
1,000,000%. For the most part. I don't think we've had a single incident where someone was disrespectful, or like sometimes you'll see a kid try to chase after him or something like that.
Oh, so you haven't had any instances where humans lose their mind and try to force an animal to do something it doesn't want to do for a photograph
no.
or anything? Well, that is
No, to the contrary. We've even had some picnickers that have come and picnicked, and now they're proud alpaca owners. They stay in touch and they learn more and more. So it's a small community, but it is a growing community because the fiber is becoming more and more in demand and becoming more and more discovered. I know it's illegal to import alpacas from Peru, and that's been that way since the hand, foot, mouth disease thing.
Hoof and mouth.
Yeah. And then so they've had to build out bloodlines here in the States to start producing more and more fibers to kind of try to keep up with the demand. So it's, and as more people are becoming more aware of natural fiber versus, you know, when there's a report that comes out and says 100% of placentas now have microplastics in them, and this is human placentas.
Yes.
It's,
and we joked about umbilical cords at the beginning of this podcast, but umbilical cords also have microplastics in them. Yes.
Yeah. It's scary. So the more we can get people to start, you know, embracing more of those natural fibers and natural things all across their lives versus all the synthetics, I think the better off we'll be.
So for these alpaca picnics, what could someone expect when they come for one of these picnics? What do they do? And how are you involved in your photography skills?
It's an hour and a half. You come and you can pick whether you want a traditional American picnic catered meal or a Mediterranean catered picnic meal by Susu Feeds You. And she makes, oh my God, that chicken shawarma it's ridiculous. But so you can choose which menu you want. And then we have the picnic table set up with all the little picnic things. So you've got your placemats and you've got your picnic basket and you've got the food. And we give you jars of grain to feed to the alpacas. And we teach you how to feed the alpacas. And there's a picnic blanket, and we encourage people to put the picnic blanket down on the, right now it's all brown, but in the summer the lawns and the pastures are all green, so put it down on the grass under the tree, because when you do, then the alpacas become more and more curious about you, and then when you're sitting down and these big goofy looking necks are just coming encroaching up above you, it's just, you can't help but laugh. So you basically get the pasture to yourself with the alpacas, and we teach you a little bit about them. We show you a little bit about the fiber. We show you a little bit of the product that can be made from them. Unless you want us around, we just leave you alone to kind of make your connection with them. And that's it. You picnic with the alpacas.
And what about your photography skills? Are there photographs offered? Because yeah. I believe that's the case, right? You also will take photographs of the people enjoying their picnics?
That is one of the things as well, yeah. I will take photographs of them with the alpacas, and especially if they have kids, it's just so much fun. And we'll provide them with the either the digital copies, or I get them printed and framed for them, depending on what they're looking for. But keep that memory and take it with you and share it and teach other people about the alpaca.
So perhaps they could just sit there and enjoy the picnic and not worry about having their cell phone out every few seconds to get selfies and photographs, because you can handle that for them.
That right? is true. Yes, that is true. So we've actually, I think some of the most satisfying moments were, there's a lot of tourists that come up here from San Francisco, Silicon Valley, like that area. And so they're very high strung techie people. And I remember at least two very clearly where they'll come up and they're on their phone and their wife and their kid is like all happy to be here with the alpacas and they're still doing and they're talking on the phone like
their Bluetooth headset.
Yeah, they're that whole thing. And they're pacing back and forth. And then literally 15 minutes into, once you put them in the field, their phone is down, the Bluetooth thing is down, and they've completely changed. And some of the comments and some of the reviews that we got from some of those people were like, if you let yourself slow down, then it's one of the most amazing experiences you'll ever have. And that was like music to our ears, because that was the whole point, is just to like forget about all that just for a few minutes and connect to the earth. And so those were some of our most satisfying moments, was when those high strung people all of a sudden become like kids. Yeah, and they don't have to worry about taking all the pictures and all that stuff. We'll take care of that for them.
We've run the whole gamut now, from you growing up in Culver City, making interesting decisions in college that have led you down a variety of paths that have taken you through commercial filmmaking, photography, working with nonprofit groups, 360 video, struggling like everyone during the time of COVID, and ending up now where a lot of those things have merged together, working in a world surrounded by alpacas.
Yes.
So I think we're getting close to finishing up the show. So what I think we should do before I get to the famed final question is, Where should people go if they want to see some of your photographs, if they want to find out about alpaca picnics, or keep up with anything that you're doing? Where are those places they should go to?
Sure. My personal photography, they can go to photographybywasim.com. As far as the picnics, they can go to pacapicnics.com. As far as the store, if they want to check out some product, they can go to alpacabydesign.com. Also encourage you to look into, if you're in Oregon, check out earthdayor.org. And if you're not in Oregon, if you're in one of the other states, then I would encourage you to also get involved or check out the Earth Day chapter in your state as well. Oh, and the photos, I put a lot of them on Instagram. So that's at Wasim of Nazareth. Is the handle.
All right. Do you remember what the final question of this show is? I know you're a listener.
I am.
You at least historically have been.
I have been. remind me.
It's, All right. Here it comes. Based on everything that we've talked about today, what is the final thought that you want to leave the audience with?
The final thought I want to leave the audience with, slow down, unplug, and connect. No, I'm going to change that. That doesn't make any sense. Always, always, always embrace your inner child, because that curiosity is going to lead you to the most memorable experiences and memories in your life. Once we think we know everything, I think that's when we realize that we don't really know anything at all. It's just don't get stagnant. Always be curious. Play, be a child, and get outside.
It's funny. I was just having a conversation with somebody yesterday about the dangers of, as you get older, not being open to learning new things or experiencing new things and thinking you have all the answers, and how that stagnates you.
Yeah.
So you've piggybacked on a conversation you weren't even part of.
There we go.
All right. So thank you for sitting down with me at the barn, at the farm, at the barn on the farm on this day that started out to seem like it was going to be covered in rain, but the sun has come out so that we can enjoy the alpacas.
Yeah, man.
And yeah, thanks for having this conversation with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And if all of this alpaca talk got you interested in their products, you may be happy to know that Alpaca by Design is releasing all new hiking socks later this month in mid-August. And a percentage of their sales are going to go to Quechua Benefit, who we discussed earlier in this episode, and also the Peruvian artisans that they work personally with and have handpicked to help make some of the products that they sell. In the words of Wasim, merino wool is awesome, but alpaca is awesomer. So if you want some awesome socks, head over to Alpaca by Design later this month. And now it's the part of the show where I invite you to go to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this episode 124 with Wasim Muklashi, and you're going to see lots of photographs. I highly recommend going to the website and taking a look. He is an excellent photographer, and we've got a lot of his work there for you to look at. It is well worth your time. And there are links to the many, many things we talked about in this episode, and they are all worthwhile as well. And if by chance you'd like to get in touch with us here at the show, you can do that a number of ways. You can send me an email, jason@gogetoutside.com, or leave a text or voice message at 818-925-0106. And please do this sick boy a favor and go to your podcast purveyor of choice. Make sure you're subscribed. If you would, rate and review the show, but most importantly, please share it with someone who loves alpacas. And a reminder, take a look in those show notes and check out that YouTube video all about my road trip across the Western United States and recording episodes such as this for the podcast. Next time on the show, as long as everything goes well, the next episode will be coming to you from Spain on August 16th. It will be the return of Jeanette Stosky. Longtime listeners may remember her from Season 1, Episode 17. She is coming back for our 125th episode to tell you all about her work with AOR, the Association for Outdoor Recreation and Education, a really exciting-sounding family road trip from Michigan to Alaska, her open water swimming, and her brand new book, The Outdoor Leader. So come back August 16th, Johnette Stosky. See you then.